My sobriety date is 11/29/1992, and I got sobered in Vancouver, Canada. So you might hear that come out. We got a Canadian there in the audience? Hey? Hey? And my home group here is Kai's, Saturday, Sunday, 7 a.m., which is in lovely downtown Cardiff. If you haven't been there, it's a great meeting overlooking the ocean and the whole deal. And you're certainly welcome to come down and join us at any time. We'd love to have you. My original home group was Kitson in Vancouver. And, you know, that's where, where I sobered up a number of years ago. In that 1992, you know, was historically was an interesting time because that was the first time that in the World Series that it was played outside of the United States. And it was played in Canada. And the Blue Jays won, and they beat Atlanta 4-2. And that was on October the 24th, 1992. And I'm not a big baseball fan, but I remember that because I was sitting in a cultural palace of distinction in East Vancouver, and I can guarantee you it certainly wasn't on the must-see or must-do things for Vancouver because East Vancouver is kind of the exhaust pipe of Vancouver, and but you know that's where I drank. You know, I drank down in those places that were, you know, down and out, and that's where I was most comfortable. And little did I know that on October the 24th, that in a short couple of weeks later, I'd be in AA. And by the grace of God, I'm still here today. And I owe a lot to this program, and it just, you know, it's such a gift. And I really love talking about the program, and I love giving the program away. And I think that's so important for us in order to keep it going, because there are those out there who are still suffering. And before I go any further, Ron, Eric, and Sarah, congratulations on receiving your cakes. It's great. I always like the celebrations. And congratulations on the other two recipients on the 90 days. It's a great milestone, and it's an important part of our sobriety, and it's an important part of my sobriety because it reminds me of my moment. And I got to keep my moment fresh. And if I don't, I'm in trouble. And I keep that moment fresh. I remember that very, very distinctly when the time came up and the game was over. And, I ended up having to come into the program, or by choice I came into the program. But going back to October, and then when that happened, I came into the program shortly a little after in November, and that was the first Grey Cup that I didn't get to participate in the parade. Now, the Grey Cup is kind of like the Super Bowl in Canada, the Canadian Football League, and it's classified as the biggest drunk in Canada. And I'm sure that that's where the soft drink company came up with Drink Canada Dry. Because that's basically, because I guarantee you that's what happened. And the Grey Cup to me it was Christmas, it was New Year's, it was your birthday, it was my birthday, it was all those days. It was non-events and events all wrapped up into one little package where I could go out and get drunk for a week. And then I topped it all off on Saturday by getting in the parade. Not just once, but I get in as many times as I could because I'd pop out, and it was always before the TV cameras. So I got to make a national ass of myself. it wasn't bad enough just to do it in a bar, but I had to do it, on national television. And that's where my drinking took me. It was I couldn't predict the unpredictable. I had no idea when I picked up that first drink where I was going, or what I was going to do, what I was going to say, or where I was going to end up. Had no idea. And it's that old saying, one was too many and 1,000 wasn't enough. And that's basically where it was. And I remember years ago, I went to college in Toronto, and went out with some of the instructors and a couple of the students, and I was in social work, if you can believe that, but I wasn't the sort of typical social worker, but anyhow, I was in social work, and I was on my second beer, and one of the instructors looked at me and she said, "You're a heavy drinker, aren't you?" I looked at it. I couldn't understand where she'd figure that out, because it's the first time I really had anything, you know, she even saw me drink. But somehow she saw something in me that, you know, there it was. And I think if you've got the disease, you've got the disease, as in the doctor's opinion, you know, which is an extremely important part, you know, in our book, that, you know, it talks about, you know, that phenomena of craving and how that whole mental obsession sets in and away we go. But I grew up in an alcoholic home. Years ago, it was a normal alcoholic home. You know, there was a divorce that happened. And there's a few things that I remember about it and a lot of things I tried to forget. But I was, and my mother were both on the receiving end of the anger and the brutality of my father. He was a fall-down drunk. And I never knew when I was going to get money or whether I was going to get a beating. And, you know, I seemed to be the brunt of whatever cross he had to bear and, whatever came up for him. It was a tough part. But what it did was it pounded anger into me. And I vowed that, you know, when I get out there and I grew up, you know, I was going to survive. It provided me with a lot of survival strengths. And you know, when I hit into the 21, that I was, you know, going to be a guy that wasn't going to get knocked around. And I certainly didn't back down from a lot of situations that probably I shouldn't have been in or I needed to just sort of walk away from. But, you know, that's kind of where my drinking took me. A lot of it centers around that gray cup. You know, when they say take cabs, I took cabs. You know, I literally took cabs. You know, if the guy left them and they were running, I took the cab. And off I'd go. You know, and it's funny we can laugh about it. But, you know, I was stealing some poor guy's livelihood, you know. I mean, you know, we're selfish and self-centered. Or at least I'm selfish and self-centered. I never thought of that, you know. All I wanted to do was go where I knew there was a case of beer. And the girl that I was going to see was a lightweight college student that I went to college with, and she didn't really drink. So I had my mindset on that case of beer. Of course, the parade's over now, the game's long over, and I'm still looking to drink. And you know, so off I went. But I was smart enough that when I took the cab, that I had my 10-speed bike with me, so I put it in the back seat, you know. Well, it was snowing out, and I forgot to tell you that part, because it's November in Canada, so it's snowing out, you know, and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to ride the bike in the snow. Well, I ended up falling asleep, and I ran into a tree going about 5 miles an hour, and so I looked, and I looked around, and I'm checking the car for damage, you know. I didn't even have a license, you know. Somebody said, "Why didn't you have a license?" I said, "Well, I don't have a car, so why do I need a license?" But anyhow, so I pulled the bike out. I locked the cab all up, threw the keys in the car, and then locked it up. And away I went in the bicycle. And I got down the road a few feet, and I saw a bus there. And I was trying to get directions, and I was waving at the guy, and you know, immediately ran into the side of the bus, you know, with the bike, and I'm sprawled on the street. And he pointed to where I go, and he says, "Geez, I think you better walk that thing," he said. And then the next thing you know. And the next thing I know, there was a police officer there, and he was going to charge me. And I said, "Well, for what?" And he said, "Well, you're drunk driving." I said, "On a bicycle?" But anyhow, that's where it took me. That's where booze took me. And I, you know, eventually I got married, and you know, that lasted for 15 years. And then when that fell apart, you know, I made the big geographical. Still drinking, you know. I mean, I never thought that drinking had anything to do with what had gone on in my life. But, you know, I made the big geographical and I moved out to Vancouver. But, you know, just backing up a bit, before I moved out, and just a coincidence, a friend of mine happened to be visiting her good friend in Toronto, and she came in from San Diego. And she flew up to see her best girlfriend, Maureen. And Maureen, at that point in time, had about 10 years in the program. And Vicky came up to visit, and I heard that she was, you know, going to be visiting in Toronto. So I phoned her up, and I was only about 75 miles away, and we got into a bit of a conversation. And what I heard in her voice, I said, "What's happened?" And she said, "Oh, I'm 2 years sober." And I said, "Wow, you know." And I wanted some. I wanted that. That's what I wanted. There was something in her voice that I really wanted. Some sort of peace, something came through, and I really wanted that. And so that was at Christmas time. So I stopped drinking, right, you know, at that point in time. And I gave away all my booze to my soon-to-be ex-brother-in-law, and, you know, and I'd stopped drinking. So, you know, everything was good. Now, I hadn't really heard about AA or paid that much attention to AA, so that lasted 3 months. And, you know, I was playing hockey up there and after a championship game, and... you know, one of the guys, a big Irish guy, used to play for Boston, said to me, "Hey, come on, you want a beer?" And I said, "Well, no, geez, I'm not drinking." "Ah, come on, you can have a beer." That was at 8 o'clock at night. 7:30 the next morning, the two of us were still drinking, and the rest of the guys were flaked out, you know, in the dressing room and that. I mean, it was just amazing. But that's what happened. I never knew. I just didn't know, you know, where it was going to go. So going back, I made the geographical, and I went out to Vancouver, lived with my buddy George out there for a bit, and you know, still drinking. We went down to the Canby, you know, that wonderful cultural palace of distinction, and we used to drink there all the time, and you know, and tell the same stories over and over again. You know, as the Irish say, you know, you don't ruin that truth. You know, it shouldn't rely on facts. You know, so. Yeah, which is very important when you're you know, telling stories. So I've got some people in front here who are going to keep me honest tonight anyway. So I was in Vancouver, and that was going back to, as I initially said, that was in October and that year. And then George said to me, he said, "Oh, you know who's in town?" And I said, "No, who?" And he said, "Vicky." And I said, "Oh, you're kidding." So, you know, and Vicky was the one who I'd talked to, you know, on the phone. And he said, "Well, why don't you come on out? She's working out the same place I'm working, and let's go out together for lunch." So I did. And, you know, we met, we talked, we went out for coffees for a couple of times. And then one day she said to me, "Would you be interested in going to an AA meeting?" And, geez, I thought, well, I hadn't really thought of it, you know. So I said, "Okay, I'll go. When is it?" "Well, it's a Friday night." So, you know, Friday rolled around, and back down to the Canby I go, and I had a couple of beers, and George looked at me and said, "I thought you're going to an AA meeting." And I said, "Well, I am." I said, "Don't they drink, you know?" And anyway, so we went to this little mini roundup that they had. And there was a guy speaking there by the name of Barney, and God bless him, he's not with us any longer, and he did die sober. And Barney had wet brain, and he was in and out in terms of his thought process, but he was an extremely funny guy. And he said enough at that particular time that it caught my attention. And, I was listening to Barney, but Barney died a couple of years ago, and he lived downtown Vancouver on top of his store. And when he died, his family at the funeral couldn't believe there was well over 200 people at the funeral. They didn't realize he had that, you know, that many friends. But, you know, Barney used to talk about, you know, things going on in our lives and, you know, in the program, and, he, you know, when things are going into chaos and everything else. And he used to say, "Well, it's kind of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic." And I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When it's going down, and you're going down with it, you know. But anyhow, so that kind of caught my attention. And then I... on the Saturday night, I went out to see a buddy of mine, and we had a, you know, he said, "Come on over, I'm babysitting my daughter," and I said, "Yeah, I'll come over, I'll bring some beer over," you know. So I took over a 12-pack of beer, and Stan was one of these big football players who played in the Canadian Football League, and he had 4 beers and I had 8, so that kind of tells you know, where I was at. But the important thing about that was that night, and little did I know, it was my moment. I was driving home down Mahon Street in North Vancouver, and I can remember it. I just remember being in the car and everything else, and the tears start coming down. And I just said, you know, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. You know, I've had enough. And that was my moment in time. And it was time to make that big leap, you know, jump over the crevasse and get into the program and get on with my life and start living it in a much different manner. So the next day, I went to a meeting with Vicki the next day, and it was the Kitson meeting, which would end up being my home group meeting. And it's about 100 people, and it's a podium meeting. You know, so you go up the front and you talk. And, you know, at that point, I hadn't said the magical words, eh? So I was just sort of taking up chair space. And after the second person had shared, the girl chairing the meeting looked over and said, would you like to share? So Vicki grabbed my arm and she said, you know, you don't have to. So I went up to the front and I get up there, and of course, you know, I knew the drill. You know, I'd heard two people speak, so I knew what you had to say, and I kind of got my stance all set up, and I was in my cowboy boots, and I got ready, and I looked out, and I said, you know, the toughest thing I've ever done was to leave two kids back in Toronto, and the second toughest thing I've ever done is to say, my name's James, I'm an alcoholic. And it was almost like I had to pull the words out. But you know, it just lifted something off of my shoulder. And that made all the difference ever since. And God willing, you know, I'll still be in this program until the day I die, because it's given me so much. You know, and I really appreciate that. And I was, you know, noticed that it was Gary passing the phone list around, you know, and I think I got involved, you know, I got into service and everything else. And the first time I went down to AA Central in Vancouver, you know, I was on the phones. I got to take one call. That's it. They said, no, you better sit now. You just listen. I don't know what I said, but whatever I was saying, it didn't. And I don't know what happened to the guy on the other end, but whatever, you know. I hope he got to the program, but it certainly probably wasn't on my account, that's for sure, because they said, you better just listen. And I couldn't figure out why they kept always saying to me, keep coming back, okay? Just keep coming back. Because I was pretty cocky when I went in there. And I took my five-year token. This girl, Ruby, came up to me, and she was a regular there, and I don't know, Ruby had 10 or 12 years or something like that. And she said, you know, it's just now that I'm able to even get close to you. She said, the only thing you were missing in the first 5 years was a bar stool. I looked at it. I said, well, thanks, Ruby. I take that as a compliment, you know. But, you know, I hung in, and the people put up with me until, you know, all of a sudden some things started sinking in. And, you know, and then I started sponsoring people. I got involved in a men's step group, and it was one of the best things I ever did in AA. It was a great group of guys, you know, and we went over the same steps over and over again, and it was an open step group meeting, but they had the same core guys, and, you know, people came in and came out, but the same core guys were always there. And I was in that for about 6.5, 7 years, and before I ended up moving down to San Diego. And the other thing I did was I got myself a sponsor, and I think Mike's an American, actually, and you know, he sobered up you know, the hard way with old timers, and Mike's got about 33 years, and whenever I go to Vancouver, we always get together and go out for a coffee, and you know, and he's just a great guy to be around, and he really helped me in my sobriety. But there was no maneuvering with Mike. You know, I couldn't be the artful dodger. You know, I couldn't, you know, go this way or that way. He'd just nail it right down, and he'd, you know, want to know what I was doing or talking about, and he just laid it on the line, and that's what I needed. You know, I didn't need a back door, you know, to run out or whatever. I just needed to be told, you know, straight up what was going on, and I worked the steps first with a priest and then with a temporary sponsor, and then the third time I worked them with Mike. So I did the steps 3 times up there, and, you know, it really helped in my sobriety. I got involved in a lot of service work and eventually became the secretary at the Kitson meeting, and that was interesting, really interesting, because there was well over 100 people in that group, and they were a lot of different personalities, let me tell you. And as a secretary, you were the focal point, and you had to really practice, acceptance and tolerance. It was a big deal, but it was a great learning curve for me. I really learned a lot, doing that. And I really encourage you, to get involved, with your groups or, wherever you go to meetings and, be a part of it. Because, that's the fun part. That's where you really get to grow. And so, and not too much really happened in NAA. I had my ups and downs. There was, some good points, bad points. My kids used to come out and see me, every summer for a couple of weeks. And then I'd go back at Christmas time, for a week and visit with them. And I'd call them every Sunday religiously. I always phoned them, but it was always hard, especially in the first 1 or 2 years to say goodbye to them. That was always a tough part for me. But I had the program and the fellowship, and I got lots of support there. I got so welcomed by that. Then I took a meeting. I decided to start a meeting up in a maximum security institution with kids. And I ran that meeting for about 2.5 years with other people. We'd bring guests in and talk to these kids, and some of them were in there for murder and all kinds of really, serious crimes and that. And I always enjoyed going in there and delivering, the experience, strength, and hope of AA in the program, and taking in other AA members. And we sort of had a little panel, and it was a real AA meeting, for such a sort of a quasi-AA meeting, but we'd read out of the book and, talk program and all that thing. It was really important. So, my sobriety was bumping along, and then Vicki decided she wanted to move back to San Diego. And I said, well, geez, I don't know. I can't work down there and the whole deals. But anyway, she came back here to San Diego, and I ended up, following her down 6 or 7 months later, and got involved in AA down here, and we were both involved in AA down here, and it was it's been great. I really have appreciated what I've experienced in AA. AA in California is very, very similar to the AA up in or at least San Diego anyways. It's very similar to the AA up in Vancouver. Very, a lot of similarities there, except for the clapping. There isn't any clapping, I mean, when I went back up for a visit, a couple of years ago, I mean, I'm like, and I stopped just in time, because they just don't clap up there. It's just one of the deals. So we, sobriety's been good, and then I guess it was about 4 years ago. I started to notice some changes in Vicki, and then Vicki's my wife, but I haven't figured that one out yet. My first wife was also Vicki. You have those bad dreams, and you start yelling out Vicki, can't go wrong if you. So if you're thinking of getting married again, try and get somebody with the same name, or get her to change the name. Whatever works for you. But, Vicki ran into some, and she's allowed me to talk about this, because it's part of my story. But she ran into some physical problems and was taking some medication, and things weren't getting well, and things started running down for her, and it wasn't good. It was, pretty bad. She was either too tired or didn't want to go to meetings. She isolated, didn't talk to her sponsor, didn't have sponsees, and just wasn't a part of the program. I continued on my path and went there, and then it was August, around the 1st of August a few years ago, and I get a call at this, I just started this new job, and in a week, 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, I'm getting ready, I want to go home. I had enough of the training and everything else, just wanted to get home, and I get the call. And she said, I drank. I said, you what? I drank. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was absolutely devastated. this, when I mentioned about a coincidence, you know, she just happened to be in Vancouver that time, just happened to be at a job that my buddy was at, just happened to introduce me into the program. You know, that was a big part of my program. That was the foundation. And she had a really strong AA connection. She had a really strong connection with her higher power that we both call God. But you know, as it says on page 43, you know, right there at the bottom, there will come a time when we won't have that mental defense against that first drink. So I got home, and, you know, I made it very clear. You know, I drew the line in the sand. I said, you're either in or you're out. And if you're out, I'm out, because I'm not going to be a part of it. I don't want to be a part of it. And being the typical alcoholic, when I first got that call, and I'm sitting in my cubicle at work, and I'm thinking, you know, geez, where am I going to live? I got to get rid of two of the dogs because they won't take dogs. I'll have to put them down, you know, for sure. And you know, and all this stuff started running through my head, all within, you know, like 5 or 10 seconds. I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing? You know, you've got a program, like what, you know? But it just, you know, it gets going, and when it gets going. You know, and what I, when we do our readings, you know, at the opening of some of our meetings, you know, we do some of our readings, and we talk about three words that I think are so important and definitely important to me, and it's the cunning, baffling, and powerful. Because when that little opening opens up, you know, if you haven't been going to meetings, you know, that little crack opens up, then in it comes. And then the self-doubts. And then the fears, then the bedevilments, and then the poor me. And now, you know, you get to that point where, you know, you're in desperate straits. You either pick the phone up, get to a meeting, or you're going to be picking up something to drink. So I get home, and they made it very clear. She said she wanted to be in, you know, in the program. And she would go to a meeting with me, which was Saturday the next day. And I said, well, like, what happened? She said, I don't know. If you had told me 5 minutes before I bought that bottle that I was going to take that drink, I would have said you were crazy. She turned left instead of right, went into a plaza she'd never been in before, walked into a store she'd never been in before, looked at the guy there, and she picked up some Grey Goose that she never drank before. She said, I haven't drank in almost 18 years. And the guy said, oh, well, this is pretty good stuff, you know. You can always find help, you know. It's out there. You know, and I'm really, really happy to say that this next Saturday, a week from today, that Vicki will be taking 3 years. Because she does have a good program, and I, you know, she's an important part of my life. And certainly an important part of my program. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I'll you know, get to the wrapping things up here. But, you know, I'm a big believer in the book. You know, I got a lot of pages here highlighted and underlined and that whole thing. And I really think that there's a lot of good things. And when I get in trouble, I pick the book up. You know, I'll open it up wherever, and I just start reading. And there's always something there that, you know, that comes out that's really, really important. And I like to keep the, you know, the program simple. And a couple of years ago, I think a friend of mine who also takes her token, we share the same day, not the same year, but the same day, the 29th of November, and she gave me a Canadian token. Now, you probably don't know there's Canadian, there's a difference. There's Canadian tokens. You anybody know that? No? Well, what it is, it's a hockey puck. And she wrote on it, turn it over. So you turn it over, and on the other side, keep it simple. And then you turn it back over. And that's what I try and do. You know, I try and keep it simple. And I turn it over. Because that's what keeps me sober. Turn it over to my higher power that I call God. It works. I love this program, and I got a real passion for it. But it really, really does work. You know, and a few years ago, with two of my sobriety brothers, who have been very fortunate to be involved in some backpacking with them. That's something that I took up when I got sober in Vancouver, and it's extended out to a couple of big trips. And we went to Nepal, and we trekked through Nepal to up into a place called the Annapurna Sanctuary. And the reason I mention that is because on the way up, you know, their highways, their roadways are just a small path. And you go through these little villages and that. And I'll tell you, those people over there are, you know, really happy. You know, an interesting group of people. But on the way up, you'd be coming up these hills, and we got the packs on our back, and you'd hear the little children, you know, and the little voices out there, Namaste, Namaste, Namaste. And Namaste means the God in me sees the God in you and recognizes the God in you. Namaste, Namaste. You know, and that really, really struck me, and it really changed me a lot too when I came back. After I came back from that trip, you know, I'll never forget that, and never forget that saying. It's a part and parcel of me now. And I think that, you know, the important thing about it here, as far as our program goes, is that we need to recognize that in some of those people that are out there, me included, that are still suffering. And we need to carry our program to them. We need to carry the program of AA that's in the book. That's the program of AA. Not a watered-down version, but this program here that on page 45, it talks about, you know, our dilemma was lack of power. And then a little bit further, it talks about the purpose of the book is to find a power greater than ourselves. And that's the, you know, what we need to carry to these people, because that's where they're going to get their hope. And when they need faith and they have to hold on as tight as they can, then, you know, that's where they're going to get it, is from a higher power, whatever that higher power is. For me, it's God. And, you know, I'd like to thank you, you know, for inviting me here. And appreciate your attention. And God bless you all, and Namaste.